No more bullshit.
You want answers?
CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. That's the Daily time for the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm Stilly Herlambus, your host. I'm joined in studio by Richard Poplack, author of Until Julius Comes and Daily Maverick Journal, and Andrea Teagle, our resident intern and go-to rent-a-crowd person for the show. We're going to kick off with a little bit of fun, changing up the formula for the show. We've got a word of the day and a fact of the day, and we hand over to Andrea for that.
Okay, great. I'll start with the word of the day. It's not actually an English word, but I think we could incorporate it into English quite happily. It's actually a Tsonga word, and I'm not sure about pronunciation, but the word is rwe, and it means to sleep on the floor without a mat while drunk and naked. So I think that could be used quite fruitfully.
Yeah, and probably has been used quite a lot without people knowing that there's a word for it.
Exactly.
I feel enriched.
It is now part of my lexicon, no doubt about that. I should have known that word a long time ago.
Yeah. So how does that pronunciation go again, Andrea? Or spell it for us.
It's R-H-W-E.
R-H-W-E. Okay.
So, there's no one here who can really help.
It almost sounds like a sound you would make in the fetal position on the floor.
Or
like
when you wake up
realizing
that it's going to be a really bad day.
Okay, great. And the fact of the day?
So the fact of the day is about people's pupils dilating and how what you can tell from that aside from whether or not they're high. There's been quite a lot of research which shows that when people are very engaged in a task, their pupils dilate, and it's like a measure of how difficult the task is. Well, alternatively, if people are very attracted to the person that they're looking at, their pupils dilate as well. And maybe because subconsciously we associate dilated pupils to that person feeling attracted towards you, the response often is that people will find other people with dilated pupils attractive in return. So the economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman, also not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, but in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, he described research where a whole lot of people were presented with pairs of pictures, which were identical photos of people, with the only change being that the person's pupils were dilated in one and not the other. And consistently, people rated the pictures where the people had the dilated pupils as more attractive. But when they were asked why, they had no idea at all that that was the factor.
Difference was the dilated pupils, and that made up for the extra attractive.
Right, and they all said, well, that person was just looking a lot better in the second photo, but actually it was literally, it was just an artificially enlarged pupil, and that was the only difference. So.
Okay.
Well, it brings a new meaning to the word sexy pupils. Finally.
Richard, you've had a bit of a whirlwind couple of weeks now. I mean, the book Until Julius Come has just been out. You've been on this roadshow. You've been, being interviewed to death. How's it been? How's the last couple of weeks been for you?
Yeah, it's been an absolute, it's been a freak show. Lots and lots of running around. I landed. I was on a road trip to the Central African Republic, which is by no measure a vacation resort.
And its own freak show.
It is a strange place. And then I landed here, and then the whole Until Julius Comes tsunami sort of broke. Lots of running around, lots of interviews.
What's been the initial feedback like?
Great. It's been really, really, really gratifying. I think people are reading it. I think they're really enjoying it. Those that aren't enjoying it are not enjoying it in ways that are entertaining. And there's been some strange encounters. I ran into the official opposition leader, who is still Helen Ziller, believe it or not, last night, and she was decidedly unhappy to see me. Yeah. So
there was a bit of frosting on her case.
There was a little bit of frosting.
A little bit of frosting.
So you gain some followers and you lose a few.
Yeah. Do you know if Julius has read the book?
No, I don't believe he has. I do know that that a bunch of the upper EFF guys have.
Yeah.
I don't think he does a whole hell of a lot of the reading.
Yeah.
And that's not for the reason most people think. He's got a G in woodshop. But he's not everyone's idea of a great pupil. dilated or otherwise. But he's a really, really busy guy, and you know, this is stuff he it's probably best he stays away from.
Definitely. And what's been the feedback by those guys? I'm guessing it's Andile and
Andile and Zitama and Moya Basani Ndlozi, who's the national spokesperson. Andile called me a cuck writer, although he believes although he believes I write very well, the stuff that I write is utter cuck. So there you go. That's one view.
Well, that's one review.
But Yasani was actually reasonably complimentary about some of the stuff, but didn't understand some of the positions that I arrived at.
Pertaining to the EFF, yes, or to the
EFF. I have no doubt they agreed with just about everything I had to say about the other parties. But with regard to the EFF, I think we do drift on points of ideology. Although probably not as much as they think. I mean, I'm a born and bred punk. I'm not right or left. But as far as Andile is concerned, I'm a right wing lunatic who's probably best served joining the Tea Party in the United States of America. Anybody left right of Shay is left of. Of Andilla. So yeah, it's all there. It's all sort of swirling around in the ether.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're a Julius Malema expert now? The timing, you know, one could look at the timing and go, it's quite fortuitous, but I think it's more by design, really, because that was kind of the theme that you picked out from the elections, was the emergence of Julius. So not really fortuitous. It was just kind of calling it right.
Right.
You know, and so on this tour, you know, and being interviewed ad nauseum, you know, it almost comes across as you're the go-to Julius Malema expert now.
Well, I think what happened, and I'd love to say it was by design, and I'm going to say it was by design for the purposes of this conversation, is that very early in the election campaign, I identified the fact that the major meme was going to be the EFF. One of the first interviews I did was with Vikas Kotze, who was the white EFF
guy.
And when I spoke to the Daily Maverick upper echelons about going to speak to him, it was right after a Saturday Star story broke about him, which sort of portrayed him as a bit of a buffoon with a dangerous case of jungle fever. You know, this was his second marriage to a black woman. And he was besotted and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The way he was sort of cast seemed a little odd to me, but I was intrigued, and I went off and met him, and very quickly.
And obviously, no resistance from the editor to go ahead and do the story.
No, of course not. Yeah.
And then playing to the theme that the EFF was going to be probably the biggest story from the elections. I mean, recognizing
all of us, I think, sort of realized that there was definitely stories there. But Kotze for me was what sort of sealed the deal, because on meeting him, I realized that he wasn't a buffoon. He was actually a really, really smart guy, really ideologically driven. He had more than 20 years of organizing on the ground. He understood how South African politics works from a grassroots level. And South African politics is the organizing thereof is extremely sophisticated. I mean, there's parties all over the Western world, political parties who could learn enormously from the ANC's institutional memory.
That on the ground stuff.
How do you get down to the very last person in the very smallest ward in the country? Mm-hmm. These guys know how to do it. They really do. They're excellent organizers. There's all these structures that political parties in this country have to build in order to be successful.
And do you think that stems from an era or almost an entire generation where that miscommunication, segregation of, you know, preventing people from congregating, that kind of forced them into being able to take up those skills and be able to get people to mobilize in that way?
Absolutely. I mean, we speak a lot about social media and the sort of importance of social media and getting through to people and contacting people, but that's all overblown. The way things are done are the same way they were done in the 1950s. That is, you had to go into people's homes and say, look, this was happening. This is happening. Let's band together on this. The teachers are striking. The students are striking. We have a long history of that, of organizing in this country. I think we've lost, It's been commodified. It's been politicized. It's no longer civic action. We've lost that edge. That's for sure. But in terms of political organizing, the structures exist. And with regard to a guy like Vikas Khwatse, he knew exactly how to do it, which is why when he left the ANC, he was snapped up by Agang. He refused to join the DA. He was snapped up by Agang, realized that the Führer of Agang was a martinet. She was not going to take consensus. She didn't understand the first or last thing about politics in this country or any other.
Especially the on-the-ground stuff, right?
Especially the organizing, the on-the-ground
stuff. Academia is one side up in this, ivory tower, and actual stuff on the ground. And that was the biggest problem with Agang, was that it wasn't on-the-ground.
They had no structure.
It was nothing.
Right. It was what she said. There was no consensus. There was no driving from the ground up. I don't think Mapela Rampela has been interested in anything anyone has said in four decades.
besides her own words. Obviously.
Well, her own words are, of course, gold. So there's Vikas Khwatse, and the guy was really wise. He was really experienced. He was really interesting. He was really committed. And after he was canned by Agang via SMS, and he was picked up by some of his old comrades from the ANC, from the radical end of the ANC, the Youth League, who had now switched over to the EFF. And from a comrade, he became a fighter, and that was that.
How much of the EFF is political grandstanding, or the MO is political grandstanding, in your opinion? And how much is substance, because we look at something like, pay back the money in parliament. And there's an element of grandstanding to the one side. And the other side is you kind of get the feeling that, to be an effective opposition, we need to break some rules now because the normal channels just aren't working anymore. And people are now sort of looking to them to be this official opposition, which, isn't afraid to break rules. But how much of it do you think is substance, and how much do you think is grandstanding?
Well, right now it's pretty much all theater. My frustration with the EFF, insofar as I have any, because believe you me, I'm enjoying the show with the rest of us, is it's been a year now. Their key principles, which were evinced in their election manifesto, was a nationalization. In other words, they're gonna take over the banks, they're gonna take over the mines. Et cetera, et cetera. B is give us our land back. So they're going to take the land back. Where are the documents to sort of back this stuff up?
To show
how is it going to happen? If they are going to go in with, MK veterans and with axes and pangas and AK-47s, okay, well, that's a short document, but I'd like to see it written down. Mm-hmm. If they're not, if they have other things in mind, it would be awesome to take a look at a 100-150-page document. There's lots of masters and PhDs inside that organization right now. Let's take a look. Let's see what this is all about. So right now, what we have is a lot of talk. That said, that's politics. That's postmodern politics for you. There's grandstanding all around us. I wouldn't confuse the spy tapes victory by the DA and their lawyers, I mean the DA's lawyers, essentially, as much more than grandstanding. I mean, yes, it's using the mechanisms of a democratic state, i.e. an independent judiciary, in order to cop a victory. But where's the substance there? We all know that Zuma is corrupt. At this point, what is the DA about? Where are they going? I mean, their stuff is as thin as the EFF, if the EFF's is.
Yeah, I remember reading a piece yesterday by Ranjini Munasami about, people calling the time of death getting the scribes are getting their pens out to call time of death, pen the time of death for Jacob Zuma. And she's of the opinion that the Teflon man, who's managed to bounce off and bounce back from so many massive scandals that would have, taken out so many other people in the past, she expects him just to carry on and be able to, and really just bounce back from what is just another, might seem like a big victory to the opposition, but something that he'll still be able to go on from here.
To negotiate, absolutely.
Yeah.
Look, Ranjani's batting rate is 99.9% on this kind of thing. I mean, she knows what she's talking about, and I agree with her. There is no way the ANC is going to allow the spy tape saga or Nkandla to take Jacob Zuma down. To look weak in the face of those two particular broadsides would be suicide. They can't allow that to happen.
Something you said last night on the show, on the Justice Factors show, was that they might be on the ropes and they might be reeling, but to go and do something like a recall of the president now would just look incredibly absurd. Weird.
That's, you know, the most powerful liberation brand on this continent capitulating to what essentially are, you know, scandals that they've weathered time and time before over the course of the past 20 years. I don't think Jacob Zuma will last his term. I think his health will be used as an out at some point. I don't think he's well. I really don't. Of course, because we're allergic to transparency in this country, we can't know whether he's very, very sick or not. He's a man who's weathered a lot of stress. He's a man who has been in prison for many, many years.
And isn't it funny how those leaders of sometimes dubious or questionable morals seem to have this ability to outlast and outlive and outplay the rest of us, you know?
Yeah.
Thinking of Uncle Bob just north of the border.
Well, Bob's an amazing sort of anomaly. Look at him. Look at him go.
He's just getting younger, right?
Yeah. He looks more energetic at 90.
He looks younger than Helen Ziller does now.
I'll tell you, he looks fitter than Zuma does.
Yeah.
By a long shot. I mean, Zuma looked completely unwell. And, you could see it in the pictures. You can't even hide it. I think the City Press on Sunday laid three pictures: Zuma 2006, Zuma 2010, or 2009, and Zuma 2014. And boy, oh boy, do you see a marked decline. You put three pictures of Uncle Bob alongside each other, and he is literally getting younger in each picture.
Yeah. You know? That would be the same for Helen's as well.
But yes, it would, but for different reasons.
But Uncle Bob seems to be au naturel. But just getting back to Jacob Zuma for a second. So they might use his health, but then does that imply that there is a faction inside the ANC saying, okay, how much more of this can the organization take? How much more do we have to put up with, before we need to do something? And it might not be an official recall. They might use the health as an out there. Do you think that's, the party is starting, the upper, the inner circle are starting to think like that?
Yeah. I think people like Jesse Duarte and Gwede Mantashe are very, very committed to the party. Like, this isn't a joke. The ANC isn't a joke for many of its members. For many of its members, it is simply a means to get wealthier. But for others, it's a serious ideological home. It's not a joke. And the damage that the ANC is weathering over the course of this whole Zuma controversy, which is, and you could use presidency and controversy interchangeably when it comes to his sort of when it comes to his time at the helm of this country. Without a doubt, they're feeling beaten up, and I would imagine that there are contingency plans afoot. But if you think it's going to be the spy tapes, or if you think it's going to be in Nkandla, you're out to lunch.
Yeah. Do you think the Workers' Party is going to have an effect on the street cred of the EFF once it launches, for example? So taking over that role of representing, the man in the street.
Well, a fragmented left is not going to do anyone on the left any good in this country. I think the emergence of the EFF, why it was such a big story, and why perhaps a few of us initially sat on it and thought that Julius Malema wasn't really going to get anywhere, is that we didn't understand how much hunger there is on the streets, in the townships, in smaller marginalized communities for a radical and viable left. That voice needs to be articulated in the political sphere, and that's what the EFF has done fantastically well. Once you start to fragment that, things start to look a little shakier. I think a Labour EFF coalition led by Julius Malema would be an immensely sexy party in this country, and they would be official opposition by 2019.
It would change the dynamics of the political landscape.
Yeah.
It would turn it on its head.
Yeah, the ANC no longer has a viable left within the alliance. The SACP are an absolute joke. The ANC YLR, are even a bigger joke, except they don't have a punchline. And then there's Kasatu, which is a disaster. So I think there's certainly the hunger for it, certainly the appetite for it. It's going to be what defines the political future of this country in the near term.
So just to get back to some of the aspects of the book, and I know Andrea's got a whole host of questions lined up about the book. Do you have a favorite essay from the collection, from the book?
Wow.
Do you have one that stands out? It could be like your flagship one from the book. Or
I think I have a couple of favorites, and the first one was the inauguration of the party bus, the EFF party bus, which I went to Elias Mozzaletti, which is a small community in Soweto, and watched them sort of launch their party bus on an unsuspecting public who absolutely loved it. I think that essay really broke the idea of Hannibal Lecter and the idea of this collection. And I think it did some very, very interesting things in terms of pushing the limits of South African on-the-ground journalism, taking it into a gonzo way that wasn't necessarily derivative. So I'm quite proud of that essay. And then, I think the one that sort of follows that logically is their final election party. Mm. Their thank you for coming in Adderidgeville in Pretoria.
The Teletubby.
Yeah. And that had the Jacob Zuma looks like a Teletubby in his red onesie line. I think those two would be some of my favorites. But I also like the Nelson Mandela stuff that came just before this collection. And one of the pieces from that is included in the book. I think those are strong essays.
Andrew, you had some questions. You wanted to attack our resident. Attack.
I just wanted to find out more about the actual writing, that, you know, the whole process of putting the book together, and what it was like writing those individual pieces in the heat of the campaign trail. You know, did you just feel like you were on an adrenaline high the entire time?
Yeah, pretty much. I literally wrote with a bottle of Glenfiddich beside the computer, and it wasn't the same bottle. It was many severals of bottles of Glenfiddich.
Okay, are you being serious there?
I'm actually being serious. My Maverick stuff, because it's late and you need some kind of fuel, it's either going to be coffee or cocaine or, it's going to be, you're going to need some crutch to get you through this stuff. I mean, you literally are the moor of your anchor to reality when you're doing these political pieces starts to slip. Yeah. Because everybody is contesting the real estate of reality, and it gets kind of terrifying. I mean, you kind of need to numb yourself a little bit, otherwise you are going to go insane. And there's I don't think I'm the first political journalist who has needed his Scottish mouthwash in order to make it through the night. It was absolutely just done in this kind of insane 5 month. Rush.
Did you sort of feel like there was like a plot in your mind which was unraveling in reality? Did you kind of have an idea of how it was going to play out? Were you trying to sort of, you know, like stay one step ahead? Or
I think anybody who had any idea how these things were going to move day to day.
Yeah.
Look, you could have guessed that there would have been cracks in the DA Ahang marriage.
Definitely.
But not 4 days later. Come on. Yeah. it's a Britney Spears marriage.
Right.
Now I get it.
Okay.
There's things you just can't anticipate. I mean, you can anticipate quite a party at an EFF rally, but you can't anticipate 20 motorcycles following him into the stadium, and revving their engines
and who comes up with this shit?
Seriously,
who does?
Is there a Hollywood screenwriter behind all of this? Yeah. I mean, there was, but behind at least a Hollywood playmaker behind the DA's campaign. Yeah.
And what is the stuff you're taking to get this creative? I want some of that.
It is kind of like one big bizarre acid trip.
Yeah.
So you don't really know what's around the corner. I mean, obviously, all of us, there was things we could anticipate, but the day to day of it, absolutely not. I mean. The DA marching to Lituli House to present them some paperwork, and saying we want 6 million real jobs, going to Lituli House in the CBD. I mean, this is so stupid.
What could possibly go wrong?
It's so insanely stupid. And then a riot breaks out for which taxpayers must protect people in blue T-shirts from the people in the yellow and green T-shirts from a running street battle. Now, all of that you can foresee. But once it's unfolding in reality, it's just like, really? Yeah. Really? Yeah. You're really doing this? Come on.
And also, so you didn't know at the time that this was going to be, they were all going to be put together in a cohesive book.
No.
Do you think you would have approached it like differently at all if you had known that? Would you have written differently or?
I did, you know, I think halfway through, I mean, it was Stilly and Branko, who the guys who spearhead Daily Maverick, and Tafelberg, the publisher's grand design. I don't know which one of you came up with this idea. I mean, you were the first one to approach it, me about it.
Yeah, we. I was speaking at the Cape Town Press Club, and two of the ladies from Tafelberg were in the audience, and they'd been harassing Branko, our editor, for years, basically trying to get some kind of book out of either the Daily Maverick or his story, which is an incredible story to tell as well. And I'm obviously a little bit more amenable to those kind of public appearances and, you know, working with people. And he's just like, no, stay away from me. I don't want to be in the limelight kind of, you know, approach to things. And
yeah, Brad was like Bruce Wayne, except shy.
Yeah. And with a sort of a Serbian hitman look about him. Yeah. And they kind of cornered us and said, look, we really want to do something. Are you guys working on anything interesting? And I think we had literally done one or two Hannibal Lecter pieces by then. And we said, well, you know, this might work well as a book. You know, take this collection. It's going to run for the entire campaign. And they were like, great. I think if we had said we wanted to do a book on horse flyers or something, they would have said yes. I mean, they were like,
that's flattering.
They were like, let's just do it. But in hindsight, I'm you know, immensely proud and happy that we had this series to start with, you know, to be our first sort of official collection. If the whole Daily Maverick thing goes tits up, at least we've got this book that we can, you know, that will, you know, have some sort of physical presence in the digital afterlife. And that was, yeah, that was kind of how it came about, sort of almost like, okay, cool, we'll go with it and see what happens. And, you know, and credit to the ladies from and the people from Tafelberg. They, you know, they pushed hard to, you know, not just make it pay lip service to the whole, yeah, we want to do a book with you. They actually did, and they pushed
hard. No, and they pushed hard, and it's a nice product. It's a handsome volume.
Yeah.
Well, I'm flattered. I hadn't learned that it was me or a series of horse flies. You know, so that's great. You know, there was sort of a coherence that came out of, well, first of all, the mandate always was, when I pitched Branko on this idea of doing a kind of Hunter S. Thompson-ish take on the elections, there was always going to be some coherence from piece to piece, and some, certainly a stylistic coherence, hopefully a narrative coherence. Of course, we learned that there can be no narrative coherence in a universe that is coming to pieces, you know,
right,
pixel by pixel. But, you know, it sort of turned out well. And yeah, I think there was at a certain point a reflection on the work that this was going to be linked into one sort of string of pearls. So, yeah, there was definitely that idea.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask about the Hannibal Lecter byline. Given that people knew, you know, that Hannibal Lecter was you, obviously your name also appeared on the article. How much freedom do you think that actually gave you? Was that also partially to sort of free yourself in your own mind from any kind of expectations that people might have on how you write or how you interpret what's going on? Or I don't know how, like, what did it do for you? Did you feel differently, like, knowing that?
No, not in any meaningful way. I mean, obviously, everything that was written in those, I couldn't just say, no, it was the Hannibal elected dude that didn't. I mean, you know, it's got nothing to do with me, so tell your lawyer
don't
that.
Don't take responsibility. Yeah.
I take no responsibility for any of the work in this volume whatsoever. Not at all. What it allowed us to do was sort of focus the entire series around a kind of sensibility, which is my sensibility, and it's the sensibility that that Branko and I have always kind of tried to cultivate, and to some degree forms the esprit of the Daily Maverick kind of project, I would say. This sort of irreverence, this in-your-faceness, this no fear, we jump first and ask questions later type deal, bolstered by serious journalism. So yeah, it was this notion that we could corral all of that within a very, very tight package, and that package was headlined by Hannibal Lecter. At first, we were doing a lot of training to our readers about this stuff. The first few pieces, I don't know if you remember, Study, but people were totally weirded out by it.
Yeah.
It's like, why is the guy mentioning the coffee at the press conference? Like, what's he writing about? It's not about him.
Get it.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, see, we're doing something different here. And I think the Hannibal Lecter element was a cue, and we won a lot of people over. I mean, people were horrified by those first few pieces just because they've never read them before. Mm. They really had read
it's almost
nothing.
Like a warning. Then when they saw that, they were like, okay, we know what to expect.
Exactly. It's like a parental warning for the lyrics on a rap album.
It says, you know, something about the state of our media, of our journalism that, you know, a lot of people haven't been exposed to that kind of stuff to recognize that. I mean, I remember one of the other previous pieces you penned that kind of got a hell of a lot of media attention was the open letter to South Africa from foreign media, which was an incredible piece of satire.
Yeah.
And it was picked up and it was basically, you know, this was the opening line. It was the foreign media in South Africa were camping outside with their graveyard vigils in front of candlelit vigils and, you know, outside of Nelson Mandela's home and hospital. And basically, you know, anything that walked was being reported on, a bird has just shat on a TV camera lens and, you know, that made CNN, you know, front, you know, made headlines.
Yeah.
And the opening line of this piece was, "Dear South Africa, please get the fuck out the way. You know, wait, that probably came out wrong. Let us explain." And there was, you know, it just followed on just, you know, we are the foreign media. And I was fielding calls from, you know, local press. Mm. And I think the Star ran with the story in the afternoon about this piece that was blowing up and people didn't realize.
The Johannesburg Star wrote a piece about warning everybody that this piece was satire, which may have been satire.
Well,
we don't know. You know.
So there was, you know, I had the reporter call me and says, and asked, so is this satire? And I'm like, yes, it is. And he goes, why do you think so many people don't get it? And I'm like, well, you know, I just haven't been exposed. I went with the line people mm-hmm. haven't been mm-hmm. exposed to it. And that's,
I mean, that is true, though, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of writing.
And the other thing about it, I will say, is that it prodded almost every single sensitivity that I could possibly mm-hmm. figure out in the South African context. I mean, this was supposed to be a very provocative piece of work. Yeah. You know, mostly because, it was a kick in the pants. It was like, mm-hmm. guys, wake up. Come on. We cannot let these people define this narrative. We can't.
And the funniest thing was some people picked up on the fact that you'd lived in Canada for a while. So you were the foreign media. And it just kind of like, you know, exploded out there and eventually got picked up on This American Life. And it was great, just incredible to see this whole thing like, you know, unravel and travel the world in you know. It was
such an interesting phenomenon. I actually wasn't in the country at the time. I was on a fellowship in Italy.
Well, that's what foreign media does.
Yeah, exactly. And I was lying in my bed after I'd filed to Branko, and I remember he posted it around 9, and my phone dinged, ping, Twitter, and then pinged again, and then it was like ping, 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 ping. It was like popcorn going off on my phone. I was just like, I'm going to turn this off. I'm going to try to get some sleep. I'll wake up in the morning. I'll see how many death threats. My God. I mean, I could read you some stuff that people I remember getting one Facebook message from one woman. And the opening line to that was, "Hi, Richard, I hope you fucking die, you piece of shit." And then it sort of proceeded to sort of list off a bunch of ways I could commit suicide and do the world a big favor. You know, lots of people were very, very angry at the piece, especially the foreign media. I mean, all of the foreign correspondents have ceased even engaging with me when I walk into a room with them. Nobody loves me anymore, Stilly. Nobody. It's really cold out there.
And that's how you know you're doing your job.
Oh, okay.
Doing your job properly. So you're back off to Canada tomorrow, right? You're back to Canada.
Yeah.
That must be feel like a completely different planet
to what is
South Africa, and also having especially followed the campaign trail so closely. I mean, does it blow your mind when you go back there and look at the, you know, the stuff that's covered in the media there versus, you know, what's going on here? I mean, I've heard it said, you know, Canada's, you know, this placid sort of, you know, straight down the line kind of place, you know, everything works, boring, wasn't the word I wanted to use, but, you know, is that your take on the place?
Well, Toronto is a very strange town. It's a very, very odd place.
With an odd mayor.
With an odd mayor.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's part of the strangeness. Yeah. I mean, something has to crack under the placid bubble at some point. It's a country that doesn't know itself yet. It's a country that is riven by a deep, deep, dark conservatism, at the same time is kind of leavened by this very, very rigorous socialism. So there's universal healthcare, and you know, the prime minister of the country could pretty much you know, run the Tea Party. So it's a strange place.
Stephen Harper.
Yeah, with some strange contradictions. And it's not like that isn't, you know, I wrote a couple of pieces about Stephen Harper for the national newspaper in Canada, the Globe and Mail. And on the second piece, I believe the third piece, I was told to back off. You know, so it's not like that isn't a space that is that is contested as well, and can be quite let's say intellectually dangerous. You know, I mean, I've never been told to back off here.
How is that message conveyed to you?
In an email by my editor. He said, the powers that be have asked you to back off. Read between the lines, that paper is run by the establishment. White Christian.
It must have made you so furious, didn't you? Just want to
write
more and more.
Yeah, I just popped a vein in my head. And you know, I do most of my work in Africa. I mean, 99.9% of the work is done here. So the reason for going back to Toronto, among sort of personal stuff, is to finish up a couple of big pieces, to finish up this book. And I kind of need to be out of the fray for a little while just to finish up these major projects.
The book being
the giant, Africa. Enormous,
never-ending story
of Africa 3.0. Yeah. So that book, I just need to button down and I need to go to the quietest, most boring place in the world and sort of get into a basement and not leave until that is done. And that isn't a joke. I mean, I've got to finish this book.
Mm. What's the book about? I mean, we know it's about Africa, but what's the sort of central message? I mean, is there a central message? You know, because Africa is a country, after all.
Right? Yes, it is. Well, especially when everyone's got Ebola. the thing about this book is that it's gone through about 4 billion iterations. It's been a wild, wild ride. I mean, I've been researching this thing along with the writer Kevin Bloom, another Daily Maverick stalwart of days gone by, and Kevin and I have been on this thing for a long, long time. We've gone to, I think, 20 countries at this point.
Wow.
And the idea is to represent Africa in a way that hasn't really happened before. Hard, hardcore investigative journalism that really takes us through the story of Africa Rising.
So you say representing Africa the way it hasn't been done before, but I mean, you kind of got... Almost, we know the sort of forgotten, lost continent story that's been sort of pervasive over the last century or so, and then we had a little blip of Africa 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how's this book not, you know, is going to be different? I mean, is it going to be more real, more raw? I mean, versus those stories?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Kevin and I, our conception of sort of the three stages of African development, the first stage being the pre-colonial era, you know. Dozens and thousands of civilizations sort of coming together, going apart, a rich, varied history, not a wonderful history. This isn't no noble savage history by any stretch of the imagination. It's a difficult history, but it sort of comes to an end with colonialism. But Kevin and I don't separate the end of colonialism and the beginning of liberation as two different stages. We sort of see that as an arc, all of which leads up to the year 2000. In the year 2000, what happens is that the world shifts in a very fundamental way, and Africa starts to rise in sort of the nature of raw economics. All of a sudden, growth rates start rocketing up, GDP rates start rocketing up. A lot of that has to do with the sort of incursion of China as a major player onto the continent, the rise of the rest of the developing world, or the rise of the rest, as the economists would call it. And so you have these series of catalysts which are changing the continent in a very, very fundamental way. What's more, by 2050, you have 2 billion people on this continent. There's 1.1 billion now. By 2050, there's 2 billion. Nigeria will be the third biggest country in the world by 2050.
What do you know the stat for the percentage of people under the age of 15?
Yeah, it'll be well over 60.
Yeah,
it'll be the youngest part of the world in history. It's going to be nuts. It's such a transformative event that what Africa becomes is a frontier. It becomes a place where you have to come to, you have to engage with if you want to grow, especially if you're the Europeans or the Chinese or the Japanese, all of whom are shrinking. So in this weird way, you're looking at a return. If, you know, the theories change year to year, but the sort of transcendent point of our book is that in a weird way, the world, the humanity is returning here. We're coming back. This is becoming the focus again. and blips like Ebola, blips like I don't know, like you know, coups in
Boko
Lesotho.
Haram.
I mean, you know, Boko Haram. I mean, let's stop kidding around. Look at what is happening in Europe right now. Those guys can't tie their own shoes, and you know, Vladimir Putin is literally invading the Ukraine. It's, you know, this kind of stuff happens all over the world. By no means is this continent perfect, and it's never going to be. It's developing in ways that are completely unprecedented. Any theories of development, of demographic dividends, of all of this nonsense, I think we can all throw that crap out the window, and our theories will look very different by 2050. But it's going to be a heck of a ride, and we're trying to chart the moment that toggles it all, that sort of switches it all.
So you've just come back from Central African Republic.
That's right.
Is there a highlight out of these 20 countries? Was there one that kind of blew your mind to the extent that you're like, holy crap, that's not what I expected? Or did you go in with sort of no expectations?
Yeah, I think the best thing to do is go in with an empty notebook and an empty brain. I mean, any expectations you have, you're just going to get kicked in the nuts at some point, and taught a very, very harsh lesson. Look, you know.
Was there one that sort of surprised you, like, on the upside? Like, you was not at all what you'd expected, but it was, you know, completely, you know, out of the complete realm of your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I think almost everywhere we went had one of those stories. And that's not to be sort of, you know, happy-faced, cherry, positive dude. It's just everywhere you were. Even in a place like Juba in South Sudan, we'd encounter stories that are kind of strange, that kind of throw you for a loop and are, you know, you can definitely see how things are developing, how things are moving forward. And then there are places that are just so nightmarishly terrible, you just have no idea how they can get fixed. And then there's a place like Zimbabwe, where you walk around, you're like, this could get sorted out in an afternoon. You know, these guys need to sit down, have a chat, you know, take care of the rule of law, fill in some potholes, and they have one of the most amazing countries on the planet. So it's strange. A lot of the stuff we encountered, you leave feeling really, really gloomy. The Central African Republic has a century of development to do before it could be considered, you know, a reasonable place to live. South Sudan, less so. If they just got together, put their heads together, there's the will, there's the money, and they're the people, the intelligent people, people who have returned educated from the United States, the Lost Boys, to fix that country up literally in a matter of decades.
This book has been commissioned locally? Was it an international, local?
It's both. There's an international publisher, Portobello Grunter, and Jonathan Ball over here. So they sort of teamed up to give us not nearly enough money to run around the world and investigate.
It's been quite a journey, though. It's been going...
Been nuts. I mean,
it's been on for a while now. I mean,
it's been crazy. And every time we thought it was done, we'd look at the material and go, no, this is pretty good toilet paper, but it's not gonna cut it. Time and time again, we've had to sort of go back to the drawing board to where we arrived at last August, Kevin and I, and we were like, we don't have anything. This is just rubbish. We tried this really, really fancy structure. And we sat down and we knocked our heads and we were on the verge of
the Glenfiddich
suicide. Yeah, you know, I'd say, my God. I even went down to Bell's for that. And we just came up with a structure and a way of doing it that was more humble, that was less grandstanding, that was way less about us, if about us at all, that was simple and modest and true. And I'm very, very proud of us for that. I think that's sort of been our greatest stroke, is just allowing this material to speak to us and for us to get the fuck out of its way so we can tell the story properly.
Is the, I mean, I know it's probably something that you hate being asked, and especially from your publishers, in terms of a due date, when a manuscript being sent in for a final editing, and I mean, is there a launch date?
Well, Kevin and I being Jewish, every day is a due date. but in this case, I think I understand what you're asking. We're going to have a manuscript by the end of the year. It'll be a complete manuscript. It'll go into, we're very excited. Ivan Vladislavich is going to edit it. As far as Kevin and I are concerned, he's the man. In terms of a literary edit, we have lots of readers looking out over it. We're double checking, triple checking facts. So yeah, I think by the end of the year, we'll have a manuscript.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book as well as an encyclopedia sized book at some stage.
You're going to be able to bench press it.
Yeah. just before we end off the show today, and just looking back at, I mean, the campaign trail, the book, mm-hmm. Until Julius Comes. You know, you said you don't, you know, you didn't ever want a beat as a journalist. You didn't want to have a beat, but obviously getting this far involved with the Daily Maverick and with the campaign trail as Hannibal Lecter, you basically immerse yourself in the politics of this country. You know, is this the first time you've had that kind of, deep and sort of unbreakable bond with the politics as a beat or as a as something to follow?
Yeah.
I mean, and do you feel it's changed? You've grown with the experience?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. First of all, the Africa stuff over the course of the past 4.5 years, where perhaps my earlier work was more focused on culture, all of a sudden started switching to politics. I mean, you can't really look at African countries and consider them deeply without considering their politics very deeply. And then you go into geopolitics, and then you go into colonialism, and then. So, you know, having taken that journey, I've just been reading so much politics. I mean, I've been reading white papers, and I've been reading, you know, political journals, and et cetera. So all of a sudden you become steeped in all of this stuff, plus all of the theory, you know, your Wretched of the Earths and your other post-colonial theory. So you're drinking this stuff down by the jug load, by the Glenfiddich bottle load. And you know, going into the election campaign and taking it as seriously as we all did, I felt was both a compliment to my Africa work and was complimented by my Africa work. So it felt like a very natural fit. The glove just slid on, to use a really labored, really cliched metaphor, which I'd never use at the Daily Maverick, I promise you, Stilly.
Even if you did, we wouldn't let it slide.
Yeah, thank you, so to speak. Yeah. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, this South African political beat that I'm doing with the Daily Maverick is not going anywhere. I mean, this is it for the next little while. This is going to be my main gig. The day job.
Andrew, do you have any more sort of journalistic angles you'd like to interrogate our guests with?
Yeah, I think just the last thing that I wanted to ask was, you're at a point now where you can write really confidently, you know what you're talking about, and it comes through beautifully in the way you write.
Thank you.
When you were first starting out, I know that you studied film and television or something along those lines, and you realized that wasn't right for you, and you wanted to make a shift, and you decided writing was where you wanted to go. How did you move from that point? I mean, how did you build the kind of confidence that you needed to be where you are now? Like, what was the process? And didn't it feel quite overwhelming and daunting at that point, like starting out?
Well, I think confidence is a weird mixture of hope and stupidity. So, I think you know, we always need that as writers. I think, you know, it's just like, I hope what I'm doing is right, and I'm too stupid to know otherwise. So hell, this is me, you know. But, you know, hard work. I think people are always a little underestimate a little bit how much hard work writing actually is, and how long it takes to do your apprenticeship.
Well, and to give birth to 1,000 words in a couple of hours. I mean,
is the result of close to a decade's hard graft. You know, so it's. It's nothing that comes instantly, and I urge younger writers and younger journalists just not to force that element of it. You get there. You really, really do with the work. You know, one day you're going to sit down and write 1,000 words, and it's going to be like, how did I ever find this? You know, it's always hard. It's always sucking out pieces of your psyche, and it's always, you know, taking finite energy and burning it, always. But, you know, you're not killing yourself every time you're sitting down to do 1,000 words. You're just not. Otherwise, it's not a viable, you know, vocation. But, you know, I mean, my early pieces were quite, you know, some of them are really weak.
I want to find them.
the weirdest thing, I think the first thing I ever published is the most anthologized piece I ever did write. And it was a satirical piece, probably even drier than the Fuck You to South Africa from the foreign press. And it's been anthologized in about, I would say, 20 textbooks all over the world, strangely. And
so be careful about what you first write, it seems.
Because when that's the thing.
Well,
I'm just thinking back to the first piece that I ever got published, and that was in defense of Tiger Woods.
Oh, really?
Yeah. and his escapades of the fire hydrant incident.
Has that come to define
you? You defended Tiger Woods.
I defended Tiger Woods. Successfully, I thought. In fact, actually, a whole host of women came out in support of my argument, and a whole host of men didn't. So it was quite something. So I'm just thinking back. That could be my defining piece of journalism.
You probably eat for free at Hooters now.
But that's not such a bad thing. So the elections are done. The book's out. Julius has emerged. Mm-hmm. What's next for A, the EFF, and Julius, and B, South Africa, in your mind?
Well, we've got to ride all of this stuff into the 2016 elections. I mean, what's really, really strange about this cycle is that it really does feel like we're in campaign mode for 2016. I don't know if you guys feel the same thing, but I really feel like everybody is focused and sort of starting to draw the battle lines for 2016, which is a huge, huge milestone in this country's history. And I'll tell you why, and that's because I think the ANC is going to lose wards in a very, very big way. I think they're going to lose this city. I think they're going to lose Tswana. And I think they're going to lose Ekurhuleni. I think they're going to lose some big municipalities.
And is that because of the emergence of something like the Workers' Party? Or a combination of that and what we saw was almost two elections happening in South Africa side by side, the urban vote and the rural vote. And if you split those two, you would see that the drop in the metropolitan areas was much, much bigger than the overall drop that the ANC experienced. So is it a combination of the two, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, no one in the rural areas is going to be is going to risk their social grants for a whim, for an ideological whim that they don't really can't really get behind. And of course the ANC still has that emotional heft that you know, people feel
that liberation great, goodwill.
Yes, I mean that you know, major kinship with this organization. In the cities, very, very different. The DA has been doing 20 years of very, very hard work in these wards. And again, I can't stress enough how important that on-the-ground work is for politics in this country. And the EFF have been very aggressive about setting up their structures. And with people like Vikas Kutsa on the ground, they have a lot of expertise. Mm-hmm. So they are definitely going to start bleeding ANC wards from
especially if any sort of coalition with a workers union.
Absolutely,
party.
And then we start throwing the intangibles. We don't know if NUMS is going to come around to developing a workers party. I mean, they say they are, but you know, time's a ticking. Mm. We'll just have to see. If they do, you know, it's going to be a heck of a campaign.
Does that bode well for the country?
Yes. Insofar as anything bodes well for the country, and you know, that comes down to the conclusion of the book, and that is that until South Africans start being South Africans, until we start fighting for our rights, and until we're vigilant consistently, until we understand that responsibility is ours and not something that we outsource to a government, we're doomed. Insofar as we understand that, yes, the fact that there's an emerging left wing and the fact that there's real opposition and real there is an attacking left and an attacking right. That's good for democracy.
Yeah, it's the principle of more competition, right?
So well,
more,
this is com- it. Yeah,
yeah. more competition
if,
for us.
If you're a Democrat, it's good. If you're not a Democrat, it's all nonsense. You know, it's like, well, who cares who runs this place? It's all about money. And I can understand that statement. You know, this is still a mining country. It's still about who runs the joint gets to extract most of the diamonds. You know, I understand that position. I'm sympathetic with it. But if you're a Democrat, then the more viable democratic institutions, the more parties fighting for power, that's a good thing.
You're sitting across from someone who's a budding journalist who's looking forward to forging a career.
Intern with a capital I.
Yeah. What besides the Glenfiddich angle is the best advice you can give to someone looking to start a career in journalism?
Curiosity, you know, just never let that die, please. You know, there's nothing worse than a budding journalist who is cynical, and you know, cynicism is a very blunt tool. It's necessary, but it's, you know, it's got to be one tool in your toolbox. Just be curious.
I don't think curiosity and cynicism are mutually exclusive. No,
and you're right, they're not. Yeah. But so unfortunately, cynicism becomes the bigger tool, and it kind of dulls the curiosity, and that's just deadly. Read. I mean, we've spoken about this a lot. Just read as much as you possibly can, everything, and just go out there with your notebook. Your notebook's your friend.
I think that's good advice. Thanks.
Cool. Well, that's the end of the Daily Maverick Show. Another chapter. We wish you well on your travels back to Canada.
Thank
good
you
luck
very
with
much.
The rest of the book.
Thank you.
We're finishing off your other projects.
I'll need it. Thanks.
I believe you got a special delivery coming in a couple of months.
I do. Yeah.
Good
some
luck
new
with that.
Commerce.
Yeah. That's going to be a whole new campaign trail ride, emotional roller coaster. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Come back safe. We can't wait to have you back at the Daily Maverick.
Awesome. Thanks.
Cheers, guys. Thanks so much.